Hey, you want today's news today? Entertaining talk. News when it happens. Callow News Talk 1320 107.9.
The following is a paid program. Good morning. It is time for Medical Line here at Kello News Talk 1320 107.9. We're going to hook you up with the doctor today. Dr. Jerry Walton is here to answer your medical questions, and you're invited to call in at 336-1320 and 800-228-4435. Any question you have that's medically related, we'd like to hear from you today. And we've got our call greeter, Mark Brown, standing by here on the phone. Well, doctor, good morning. I guess winter has arrived, huh?
Boy, it has. That's a heavy snow. I was noticing how the trees and the bushes are really laden down with that moist snow.
Yeah, I've got a couple of trees that are still have all their leaves, and it's weighing down the branches pretty good there. Might lose a couple more.
But isn't it beautiful?
It's beautiful, absolutely.
As long as it isn't so cold.
Except when you're driving around.
Well, that's true, but you know, I've always enjoyed the snow. I just don't enjoy the cold.
You know what? How about the older you get? Do you have more... do you feel a little more uncomfortable in cold weather than you used to?
Yeah, I think so, because I remember when I was younger, I used to kind of look forward to getting out in it, either snowmobiling or, you know, cross-country skiing or, you know, winter sports or actually even doing kind of wheelies with the car. I don't know if you
really?
Ever did that, Norm.
Oh, man. I wouldn't even think of doing that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, they always had rear-wheel drive, you know.
Yeah.
And it was a lot easier to skid your car around and do wheelies with
it. You're just testing the traction out a little bit, right?
Right. Just
yeah.
I want to make sure that I can handle myself
Absolutely.
In the snow.
Yes. So, but nowadays, you don't do that much anymore. Huh?
No, I don't do that at all. Insurance rates are high, and front-wheel drive doesn't work as well.
Yeah, so, but anyway, the cold, I guess, well, winter is definitely here, and we sure got a taste of it yesterday, but hopefully it'll warm up a little bit now.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get started here. Let me give the phone numbers again here. If you've got a medical question for Dr. Walton, we'd like to hear from you at 336-1320. And 800-228-4435. You had something about Alzheimer's you wanted to share with us.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we're doing now in research a lot is going to gene therapy and trying to establish what are the genes that relate to different diseases so that we can anticipate or perhaps even change or cure a disease. And one of the things that they have found is that there are genes that make a person more susceptible to Alzheimer's. And there is a relatively small fraction of cases of Alzheimer's in ages 30 to 60. And this is what we call early onset Alzheimer's disease. The cause generally is one of several mutant genes, and they're inherited from a parent. The primary genes... well, they've got names, PSEN1, PSEN2, PSEN, and APP. And if anyone inherits one of these mutated genes, it's very likely, but not certain, they will develop the disease. Now, you know, you'd think, well, then people that have family members with Alzheimer's would want to be tested for these genes. A lot of them are not being, and it's not really encouraged because it is very costly and usually is not covered by insurance because it can't necessarily make much of a difference as far as preventing it or treating it. So insurance companies, you know, look at that with a jaundiced eye and say, well, you know, if we can't prevent it or cure it, we're not going to cover it.
Yeah, what's the point of even knowing it's there?
Right. And for some people, even though they may be at risk because they have a family member with Alzheimer's, don't want to do the testing anyway, and others want to know the risk involved. But the issue then becomes one of if you do get tested, and particularly if you're after age 60, where there is more of a gene type, an APOE, everyone carries copies of these, and you get one from each parent, but it's the APO34, if you end up with that you're much more likely to have Alzheimer's. But again, we run into the same problem. They have found that people that do have this gene don't always get Alzheimer's, and those that don't have this gene sometimes do get Alzheimer's. So we're still in a state of flux with this, and they're really, my suggestion and my take on this would be that there's no real benefit in being tested. Some have said they don't care. They want to know what their risk factor is and if there is a risk factor, and they might volunteer for early experimental treatments with Alzheimer's if they know that they're at high risk.
That's one thing you could do.
Right.
So otherwise, there isn't really a lot you could do at this point. Is there? Let's say you were tested and you had this gene, so you were more of a candidate to come down with Alzheimer's. But then what do you do?
Well, if that is the case, it might modify how you might plan your life. You know, you might be more apt to go out and draw up a will. You may be more protective of your assets, or you may want to somehow have your assets designated so that if you get to the point where you can't make rational decisions, that people know what you want. I mean, there is that involved. But again, and I go back to a story. When I was an intern, I was working with a cardiologist, and he was telling me about a case where a 34-year-old came in, and he was told he had bad heart disease and that he needed to be really careful. And so he was very careful. He did nothing with his life. He was just protecting his life so that he didn't die, lived to be in his 80s. So, you know, what was his life worth then? He actually passed up life to prevent death. And so, you know, this could happen too. If you're tested, you're found to be a high risk, you may modify your whole life. And in preparation for this, you try to do things that you wouldn't normally do because you think your life is going to be shorter, or you stop doing things that you could do that might be more risky. So I don't know. It's like if people knew the day they were going to die, it certainly would change how they live their life, I know.
I think I'd rather just put my head in the sand on a deal.
Well, I think you just live to live, not live to die.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you this about gene testing? Is it the same if an adult was tested? Let's say you took a baby just a few days old and checked their genes. Would you still be able to see that Alzheimer's gene in there?
Right.
You would.
The genes are the same.
That
what you
changes.
Get, you're inherited your genes from your parents. And if you go and look at genes and chromosomes, they don't change in a lifetime. There are what we call mutated genes where they sometimes get displaced. But again, that's generally from birth. So
that blueprint is right there from the beginning, right?
It really is, yeah.
Wow. Okay, well, interesting, though, that they do have the capability of testing for the genes as far as Alzheimer's is concerned. It is Medical Line here at Kello News Talk 1320 107.9. If you've got a medical question, we'd like you to call in here at 336-1320 and 800-228-4435. And you've got something about addictive medication that you'd like to share with us, Doctor.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about this. You know, this is such a big issue now, and they've placed more and more restrictions on the use of addictive-type drugs. And certainly one class is probably the biggest offender of being addictive and misused are the opioids. And these are drugs like oxycodone or Oxycontin, hydrocodone or Vicodin.
Pain medications?
These are pain medications, right. And that's basically what they're used for. And Dilaudid is another one. Demerol is another one. These are all in that class of opioids. And what I think is important for people to know and understand is that 97% of the people that take these are not addicted to them. And don't necessarily become dependent to them. They can be used more frequently if they're used for short term. They're used after operations. They're used sometimes with a severe injury. And if they're used for 7 days or less, and that's generally what the recommendation is, they're not usually a problem at all. If they're used over 30 days, then that's when you begin to see the dependence, and a lot of people will develop dependence.
So as a doctor, you want to be careful about how long you prescribe something like
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. And we can come back to this. We have a phone call.
Yes, we do. We've got Lee on the line this morning. Good morning, Lee. How are you?
Good morning. Pretty good. End of September, I come down with a bad case of the shingles. And I was wondering about how long should I wait before I get a flu shot? And then I want to get that shingle shot. How long should I wait for that?
You know, that's a very good question. And I'm not sure I know the answer to how long you should wait for the shingle shot because you, by having shingles, you do develop immunity. You do increase your immunity against it. So you probably don't need to consider that shot in the near future. And by the near future, I mean in the next couple of years anyway.
Okay.
So I think this should boost your immune system, and I don't know how much more you could boost it with a shot shortly after having the shingles, so I think I'd probably wait on that.
Well, I sure don't want another case of them.
No, they're nasty, aren't they? Where did you have it on the face or on the body?
Around the midsection.
Midsection.
From the belly button clear around to the backbone.
Right.
And about 6 inches wide.
Wow, you had a bad case of it, too.
Yes, I did.
And how long have you had it now?
Well, the last week of September, and they're still bothering me to be heck.
Are they bothering you mostly with the pain, or do you still have sores?
Just sore, like the T-shirt rubbing on them just irritates the heck out of them.
Do you have scabs yet or sores noted, or is it just reddened area?
Just red area. I keep kind of a salve on them.
Okay.
The doctor recommended, so.
Okay, so you said the last of September, so it's been about 6 weeks then.
Yep.
Okay. You probably are okay to go ahead and get your flu shot at any point in time that you want to. You're over the acute process. What you're going through now is the damage to the nerve, which creates that sensitivity and pain, which can go on for months. So, and it can affect your immune system somewhat. So it probably isn't a bad idea to go ahead and get your flu shot, unless for some reason your doctor says no.
He wasn't sure. So.
Yeah. No, I don't know of any contraindication to your having the flu shot, but I don't think I'd go ahead with the shingle shot at this point.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Thank you very much. Medical Line here at Kello, News Talk 1320, 107.9. We're here with Dr. Jerry Walton. The phone lines are open right now at 336-1320 and 800-228-4435. He mentioned that he had shingles that broke out in his midsection.
Right.
Where does it normally break out?
Anywhere. This is what's interesting, Norm, about shingles is that sometimes it's hard to diagnose because someone may come in just mostly with maybe like arm pain. And so you're thinking, whoa, is this heart or is this musculoskeletal? Is it a joint problem? What is it? And then they begin to show that bit of a rash or these little vesicles that may occur along the line. But it can be on down the leg. It can be the distribution of any nerve in your body. One of the worst, of course, is when it comes on the face and it affects the facial nerve and gets around the eye and can be very devastating.
You know? Now, how long does that last if somebody comes down with shingles?
Well, it varies. It depends on their immune system, for one thing. It depends on the treatment that they get. If you get treated early, you can modify the course of the disease by getting in the first 48 hours or so and get started on the antiviral medication. It can modify it. Otherwise, it can run a course. And when we talk about a course, you have to talk about the acute infection, and then you have to talk about the residual and complications and how long that lasts. Usually the acute process will go away in about 10 days to 2 weeks, maybe even up to 3 weeks, depending on the person's immune system. After that, most of that is just the sequelae, what we call sequelae, or the complications of having had the disease, and that's the pain, the redness, the tenderness, the hypersensitivity of the skin, and that can go on for a year and a half or two, and in some people, they never quite get rid of it.
And it sounded like from Lee and what you said, it's nasty. This hurts a lot, right?
It's like you said, just to have a T-shirt on, you know, just to touch your skin.
Oh, man, that's
hypersensitive.
Okay, now this flu shot, is that something fairly new that came about, or have people been getting these? I'm talking about the shingle shot, I mean.
Oh, this is...
the shingle shot. Has that been around a long time?
Well, it's been around now for years, and the shingle shot is recommended for seniors, and particularly over 60, because we do know that we carry that virus in the nerve for a lifetime. If you had chicken pox when you were young, you have the virus in your system, and that's what can cause shingles later on. And it's often associated with a depleted immune system. And as we get older, our immune system just isn't as good, and so elderly are more prone to get shingles. And then also it can happen with an acute infection process, or if you have surgery or major trauma, that will bring out this virus. So what is recommended is that seniors get the shingles shot to help protect them against it. And if you've had shingles, you know, one of the big questions we had was, then was it worthwhile getting the shot? At first, there was a question that maybe it wasn't. Now they say that it probably is, but you shouldn't have to get it right after the shingles because you've already boosted your immune system. So it's one of those things. It's an expensive shot. A lot of people do just avoid it, but if they've ever had shingles, they know what that's like.
Can I ask you, have you had the shot?
I haven't.
You haven't? Okay.
No.
So you're gambling a little bit here.
I am. Hmm. And I guess I followed the literature, and I just, for myself, I've been pretty active. I have a pretty good immune system. Hmm. And
that's a result of just healthy living and exercising, right?
Well, I think so. Hmm. You know, and part of it is what you inherit. You inherit, some people inherit a weak immune system, the inability to build and grow white cells, and a lot of it has to do with diet, and again, stimulating the heart, stimulating circulation in your body all helps to build the immune system. So I have not said don't get it. There are a lot of people that probably be very appropriate for, and maybe it's appropriate for me, but I haven't gotten it.
Okay, it's Medical Line here at Kello, News Talk 1320, 107.9. Medical Line is a service of Sanford Health and Lewis Pharmacy. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with Dr. Jerry Walton. And good morning. It's really good to have you joining us today on Medical Line here at Kello, News Talk 1320, 107.9. You're invited to call with any medical question you've got today for Dr. Jerry Walton at 336-1320. And 800-228-4435. All right, we were talking about addictive medication, and you were saying if somebody's on a certain medication, some type of painkiller, the amount of time they're on, that's real important to keep in mind here.
It does become very important, and this is why it's been very controversial as to whether you should use, like, the opioids or narcotics to treat arthritis or back pain, because these tend to be very chronic kinds of illnesses. And if you use these kinds of pain meds, you can certainly develop a dependency, because you're probably going to be using them for more than a month if you've got a chronic problem with arthritis or with back pain. So this is where, you know, you need to use judgment, and the doctor needs to use judgment in terms of treating you. We talked about dependence, and if you are on one of these narcotics or opioids for over 30 days, it isn't too uncommon to develop what we call dependency. And with dependency, that means that you develop some tolerance. You develop a tolerance to the drug where the same amount doesn't do you as much good. So,
okay, so are you talking about two different things here? One is addiction and one is dependence.
Right. And I want to try to explain the difference if I can, because dependence is where you just, the same amount just doesn't seem to be as effective, so you have to increase your dose in order to get the same effectiveness. Whereas if you have addiction, you become almost infatuated with the med. You think about it. You want more. You desire it. You want to increase it. You want the increased frequency. So that's when you are really addicted to the drug. And what we do know is that if people tend to have an addictive personality, let's say that they they really have some addiction to alcohol or smoking, they're more apt to become addicted to the narcotics or the opioids too, just by the nature of their personality, because there are people that do have kind of an addictive personality, a weakness for that. They do say that about 97% of people that take the opioids or these addictive medications don't get addicted. So for the most part, they don't. There's that 3%. And if you fall into that, it's tough times for you. But if you do follow some simple rules, I think you can avoid it for almost all people, and that is you use them for short term. You don't need to be afraid to use them for short term, but, you know, when you get beyond a week, you need to question yourself, should I be on maybe a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent, Tylenol extra strength, or some other kind of medication that is not considered a narcotic, so that you don't run into that dependency and the possible addiction with long-term use.
Okay, if somebody has surgery, they're probably going to be on some kind of a painkiller for a while, and that's generally nothing to really worry about then, right, doctor?
That you shouldn't have to worry about unless you have a highly addictive personality. For most people, they can take the Oxycontin, the Vicodin, the Dilaudid, the Demerol. Demerol was always a more common one before they came out with some of these more complex opioids. So if you keep it short, you're probably okay with that, but try to limit the amount that you take. One other caution, if you are prescribed one of these, you should take it as prescribed. If it's prescribed three times a day, take it three times a day, 8 hours apart or 6 hours apart, whatever the prescription is. Excuse me.
Okay, so follow the directions on the medication there.
Right, because they say that if you don't, and if you wait until the pain builds up, you're more apt to get a more addictive type of reaction to it, wanting it more.
Okay, because you'll really be starving for it at that point, right? You'll be in such pain. Okay, it's Medical Line here at Kello News Talk 1320, 107.9. The phone lines are open right now. If you've got any medical question for Dr. Jerry Walton, at 336-1320 and 800-228-4435. Can you give us a flu shot update today, Doctor? We got into that last week a little bit, and you were saying it is the time of year now. We got to really start thinking about getting that flu shot.
You know, it is the time of the year, and I do think that people should really consider this for, you know, for the family. There are individuals out there that saying, you know, don't get the flu shot, it's full of toxins, and you have to build your immune system. And I agree with the concept that you do have to build your immune system. And of course, this is one way to do it. By getting the immunization, you're stimulating your immune system against this particular virus. Now, is it a panacea? Absolutely not. We get probably about a 65 or 67% prevention rate. And for those that it doesn't quite prevent, but they get the illness, half of those or better will have just a mild case of the flu as compared with a full-blown flu, which generally lasts a month or 6 weeks and oftentimes requires hospitalization. And in the elderly, many times it's enough to throw them out of whack entirely and can cause their death. There are statistics out there, and one can find some statistics to say, well, it isn't worthwhile doing. But on the other hand, we have prevented a ton of deaths by giving immunizations in the past, and we've prevented a lot of hospitalizations, a lot of cut down of loss of work. So, you know, I would hope that you would strongly consider getting a flu shot this year, and now is the time. November is a good time to get it. You need about 2 weeks to build up your immune system against it, and we've already seen some of the flu around, just a few cases.
Starting to pop up?
Popping up early. So normally we think of the highest rate of flu is in, like, February. But it can go from November to April, And January and February are the high months. So now it really is the time. And can there be a complication? There can, but they're rare, and they do a better job all the time. The reason that it's not a panacea and the reason it's not 100% is because they have to make a scientific guess as to what viruses are going to be strong, the flu viruses that are coming through for the season. And sometimes they don't get it right, but sometimes there's a crossover immunity. So even by stimulating your immune system, you may get a mild case because it didn't totally cover it with your immune system. But this is why we don't always get a total prevention. And I've had people say, well, I got the flu shot and I'm never getting it again. I got the flu.
You recommending the flu shot for all ages?
Pretty much. Pretty much. And we do need to get the kids with this flu shot because...
How young of a person could you go to?
Down to two.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, we've got a call here right
all
now,
right.
Doctor. Let's go to the phone. We've got Carol on the line. Hi, Carol. How are you?
Fine. See, my husband's getting over a cold. He was wondering if he could get a flu shot. Does he have to be completely over the cold or...
He should be pretty well over the symptoms of the cold before he gets it, mm-hmm. just so it doesn't enhance or bring back some of those symptoms of the cold. So I would say once he's been free of symptoms by several days, he could go in and get the flu shot.
Well, it's been 2 weeks since he's had the cold already. When he gets something, it lingers on.
Oh, so he still has symptoms?
Yeah, he's still coughing and stuff.
Uh-huh. I would say probably wait then until that does clear. Does he smoke?
No.
Okay. Yeah, if he's still doing a lot of coughing, particularly if it's productive, I would still wait and then go in and get the flu shot in the next week or two, assuming that the symptoms are pretty well gone. If he has just a very mild cough, non-productive, and no other symptoms, feels like he has no fever and is up and about and normal activities, he's probably okay to go ahead and get it at that point.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks
okay,
for your
thank
call.
You very much. You mentioned, you said non-productive cough.
Right.
What are you talking about there?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for bringing that up then, Norm. You can have different kinds of cough. We call a hacky cough. We call non-productive. We call a productive cough. If you have a non-productive cough, it means that when you cough, nothing comes up. You don't get that sputum. You don't get the slimy-looking stuff. It's just more of a dry cough, and it may be a hacky cough just from irritation, residual irritation. So that is basically a non-productive cough. If it is productive, it means you still have a lot of stuff down in your bronchial tubes that you're trying to clear out. And so if that's the case, I think it's a good idea still to wait until you've pretty well cleared that out before you do get the flu shot.
Is it a good idea? It's the body's reaction, I guess, at coughing if you've got fluid or whatever building up in your lungs. So it's a good thing to cough then, right?
Coughing is an important thing, you know, and we do try to suppress it. And I think there is a case for suppressing the cough because sometimes it's just irritation. And the more you cough, the more it irritates. And so it gets to be a vicious cycle and it's just hard to function. So there is a place for cough medicines. But if you do have a low lung infection, a bronchitis, it is good to be able to cough that stuff out and to clear your airway. So you don't want to oversuppress it either.
All right. We're going to take a break. We'll be back with more Medical Line with Dr. Jerry Walton here at Kello News Talk 1320. And good morning. And it's good to have you joining us today for Medical Line at Kello News Talk 1320, 107.9. Our weekly visit with Dr. Jerry Walton. And the doctor is here to answer your medical questions at 336-1320 and 800-228-4435. We'd like to hear from you today. All right. We've covered a number of things. And you've got something about pacemakers and the elderly. What would you like to tell us about that, doctor?
Well, Norm, it's kind of interesting, you know, and of course we're going through this insurance thing and Bill Zartman has had these, the gals from the insurance companies and talking about the changes that are occurring and coming down the pike, which has been hopefully a real value to all of the listeners at Kello. what I wanted to specifically talk about is the fact that they're doing testing now, and they've been testing the use of pacemakers in people that are over the age of 90. And one of the concerns, of course, with the law, the changes in the healthcare system is that there might be more limitations, at least this is the thought, for seniors, whether it is a knee replacement or whether it be a new hip or whether it might be pacemaker or some kind of cardiac surgery. And they did a fairly large study looking at people that are over 90. They say that if you reach 90, that your life expectancy is like 4.6 more years of living, which, you know, is a good deal of time. And we do know that if people have a very slow rate and need a pacemaker, that what can happen is that they can get lightheaded, particularly elderly people, because their circulation is compromised anyway, which may lead to fainting or to falls. It could be life-threatening. Or in some cases, the heart just can't compensate at that slow rate, and they may die as a result of this. So they've looked at this as a study, and they found that the implanting a pacemaker outweighs the risks, even in a 90-year-old person. And they judged about how the 70-somes did with having a pacemaker implanted in the hospital versus a 90-some-year-old. And they found that there are some very modest differences, that about 0.6% higher rate of not leaving the hospital, which is very low anyway. It's like a 1.2 as compared with a 0.6. So that there isn't a lot of a risk involved there, and yet it can lead to prolonging their life and quality of their life. So I found this rather interesting that they are saying that age by itself should not limit a person from getting a pacemaker. Now, if their health is bad and they've got a lot of other disease process, that really increases their risk, and perhaps it's not worthwhile.
Okay, well, I'm happy to hear that. We have a caller here. It's John on the line. Hi, John. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Appreciate it. Really great, great program. I really enjoy it.
Thanks. Thanks so much, John.
The question I have is my most recent blood lab showed everything in good balance, little high on the triglycerides. But the thing the doctor was a little concerned about was my blood platelets were toward the low side. It wasn't so urgent that she felt I needed to do something right away, but wants me to come back in about 90 days for another check. Is there anything a person can do to build platelets up? Or I know it can be a precursor to leukemia possibly, but I don't think I'm at that stage yet. At least I hope not.
Do you know what your count was?
You know what? I wish I had asked that number, and I just never thought to do it. All I know, it was still okay, but on the low side enough that there was some concern about it.
By,
so it must be toward the low end of the scale.
So probably a low normal, do you think?
Yeah, a low normal, I think, is what you'd probably call it.
I don't think anything should be done other than to recheck it over a period of a time frame, maybe, 3 months or so, and see if that's kind of your normal value. People do run different rates.
Yeah.
And then it can change for several reasons. If you have any kind of a recent infection or cold, viruses are known to really decrease platelet counts down in the below normal range for a period of time, and then they'll bounce back. Could it be related to diet? Possibly. If you're not, if you have fetish eating, if you don't eat a regular diet. Otherwise, your bone marrow should be in good shape. If you're getting a decent amount of iron in your diet, in your vitamins, I think that's the main thing. If you, do you think you eat a good diet?
Well, I try to keep it balanced. I live alone, do my own cooking, but I seldom eat out or eat fast foods. But generally, I try to include vegetables, fruits, And the meats I eat, I try to make sure they're lean. If there is a roast or something that's got some fat, that's always skimmed off or trimmed off.
It sounds like you're doing a good job.
Well, I'm working on it anyway.
You're probably doing a lot better than a lot of singles do. Okay. They tend to really just kind of not eat like a regular meal. And so it sounds like you're doing a good job with that.
Well, I've kind of learned how to do the smaller portions.
Well, that's good too. Do you feel like you feel good? Are you?
I feel good. Yeah. Of course, at the end of a 12-13 hour day, I'm a little tired out. But you know, I still roll out like 5:30 in the morning, 6 sometimes if I sleep in, and I put in a full day. And you know, I always feel good. I can't say I'm running low on energy.
I'd say that's honest fatigue.
Okay.
I would say.
Well, I'm hoping that.
I would say that just stay with a good diet and, stay with your normal activities. Make sure you get adequate rest because that also can suppress the immune system and the blood cell count. But and then I would have it checked again, maybe in about 3 months, just to see, make sure it's not heading down and not getting out of line. Your white cells and red cells seem to be normal, did they?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think anything other than just rechecking it. But if you do it, be sure that you don't have a cold or some kind of infection at the time because that might affect it.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks. I really do appreciate it. Oh, I limit carbohydrates in my diet. Can that be a factor?
It depends on how much you restrict it. You need a balance of the good carbohydrates as well as your proteins and fat. And you do need some fat. Your body needs it. So I think just maintain a good balance there and don't go overboard on the carbohydrates.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll do that. I appreciate your help. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
So the bottom line is if you do have some strange readings on those platelet counts, just good nutrition is about all you can do to maybe affect that.
Right. I mean, they do have some stimulants, but it doesn't sound like he's in that category. There's a wide normal range on platelets, and we're talking, 50,000 to 80,000, and sometimes it'll get down to 10,000, and that's below normal. I mean, that's when you're getting down there where you start thinking about some disease process or something pathological going on with the platelet count.
Okay, so just something to keep an eye on then to see what happens over time here, right?
Just recheck it as long as he feels good and he's eating a good diet and doing the things he should.
Okay, the phone lines are open here for Medical Line 336-1320 and 800-228-4435. I tell you what, we'll take a break and we'll be back with more of Dr. Walton here on Medical Line. And we are back with more Medical Line here at Kello News Talk 1320, 107.9. You're invited to call in with your medical question today at 336-1320 and 800-228-4435. And there was an article that featured Dr. Dan Heineman, our friend who's hosted Medical Line in the past year. And he's the president of the South Dakota Medical Association?
Right. Dan is now the president of the South Dakota State Medical Association. And then he wrote in his president's comments on the journal that's put out each month. And I thought this was kind of interesting, what he said. He said that he participated in an exercise called Three Good Things. And what they were lecturing on, what they were saying is that humans are wired to remember the negative. And I think we can all say that that's true. I know when I was in active practice, I could have a great day and have people be very complimentary and things go well and someone walks in and they are nothing but gloom and doom and very critical of you. And what do you remember for the rest of the day and the night is that one episode. Mm-hmm. We tend to dwell on the negative no matter how many good things happen. And what this, what they were saying with this three good things is that when we go to sleep and dwell on negative ideas, it affects our next day's mood. If, however, in the last 2 hours before we retire at night, we review our day and reflect on three very positive events from that day, that it has a positive impact on attitude and disposition. So you can wake up feeling a whole lot better if you went to sleep thinking good thoughts. And what they did say, that doing this, if you did this for 3 weeks steadily, where you just think at night before you go to sleep, a couple hours, just kind of dwell on the positives and what's really going right, what feels good, that it's similar to antidepressant therapy for 6 months.
Really?
If you do it for 3 weeks. So I thought that's kind of interesting. And again, it's mind over matter. And when we control our minds and when we control our thoughts, it does make a lot of difference in terms of surgical outcomes, in terms of disease process. You know, you can get the sour stomach, you can develop ulcers, you can get diarrhea. Some people get diarrhea just when they're going to have to speak in front of a group. Or, you know, it's that urge to go to the bathroom. You have to run to the bathroom before you can do it.
Yeah, what goes on in our mind seems to have a lot to do with our body.
A tremendous amount.
You seem to be in a pretty good mood today, so I bet you were thinking some
dwelling on the positive.
Yeah, three good things last night, huh?
Well, I like to think about the positive, yeah. And I don't always, if I'm really hung up on something bad, as we all can be, whether it's maybe taxes or whether somebody's really told us off or with
your spouse. You can't come up with three things?
You know, and I did think about that. That is a problem. Then I would dwell on two.
Okay.
Or one. If you've got one really good thing happen, go over it and over it.
That is a good adjustment there. That'll work. Okay. Well, so it sounds like, though, that there was some actual positive results from this positive thinking.
Right. That you actually wake up feeling more refreshed and you approach the next day with a much better attitude. So how you start your day often determines how you finish your day, mm-hmm. too, because if you get off, get started on a sour note, that tends to propagate. You know, you tend to get more negative things happening to you during the day, or at least you accept them as being negative when you could look at a positive
side.
Well,
we really do have a choice of what we're thinking about. Sometimes it seems like your mind has a mind of its own.
Right.
I mean,
that's a good way to put it.
I mean, it just goes in a certain direction, but we can force it to, dwell on something positive and not think about some negative.
Right. Absolutely. And that's what people need to do, not only before they go to bed at night, but during the day, is to try to let some of the negativity leave by overpowering it with, you know, the good stuff. You know, think about the people that you love and that you're surrounded by, family or love or your pet. You know, I think that's one of the ways that people sometimes pull themselves out of a funk is by, you know, getting the dog and they come over, put their head on your lap and you pet them and they look up at you with those big eyes and all of a sudden things look a whole lot better.
We're going to have to get Mark Brown or a call greeter to try this too. It'll maybe cheer him up a little bit.
Is he negative today?
Well, once in a while he's a little bit negative, so we'll get a handle on that. So very good. Well, that was very interesting that Dr. Dan Heineman, who's been on Medical Line here in the past, and I'm sure he'll be popping in here again sometime when you're on one of your hunting trips or fishing trips.
Right, I would hope so.
Okay, and then you've got something else here you wanted to share with us today, and what's that, Doctor?
Well, I thought this was just more of kind of an interest to people. It probably isn't going to change the way they're living or much, but maybe it's a boost for those that have sleep apnea, because what they did a study on sleep apnea patients and those that they put on CPAP, which is a positive pressure apparatus to help you breathe better and get more oxygen at night for those times when you just quit breathing. And then you wake up really in a funk because you're just tired, fatigued, it's hard to go. And people that have sleep apnea and have gone on CPAP have found that, boy, it makes a whole lot of difference. When they wake up in the morning, they have a whole lot more energy. Well, this was kind of interesting because then they did a study about how do people appear, those that have sleep apnea and aren't on CPAP and those that have sleep apnea and were on CPAP. And they had 22 volunteers to look at before and after photos to rate them for attractiveness, alertness, and youthfulness. And it was kind of interesting because the people then that looked at these photos have taken with people with sleep apnea that were before they were on CPAP and then after they were on CPAP, it found that 68% said the faces in the post-CPAP photos appeared more alert than those that hadn't had CPAP. 67% said the faces in the post-CPAP photos appeared more attractive. And 64% said the faces in the post-op photos appeared more youthful. So what they're basically saying is that it helps to take away some of the under-eye redness, the cheek redness, forehead surface volume, all decreased with the CPAP. And you look better, and it's because you do feel better. So I thought that was kind of an interesting phenomenon.
Wow, that is very interesting. Now, I've heard of these CPAP devices, and I guess a lot of people are having problems with sleeping because what, their breathing gets interrupted? Or
right. Normally what happens is that we don't even think about breathing. You know, we just do it. And when we need to take a breath, we do it. And it's because when the CO2, which is the byproduct of metabolization, builds up in your system, it stimulates an area of the brain that makes you want to breathe. And okay. That's what you do. But for some people, when they're sleeping at night, that CO2 builds up in their system, but it doesn't stimulate them to breathe. And so they just quit breathing until it gets so high. Then sometimes they'll gasp, take a deep breath, and then they breathe for a while, and then it tapers off again. So these are the people that benefit from it, because if they go for long periods of time with a buildup of CO2 and a lack of oxygen in their blood, then it begins to affect their brain. It affects the organs of the body, their skin, and that's what happens.
Then this device now, is this some big thing you're putting on your head or what? I'm sorry, I don't know anything about it, but...
Well, it used to be. It used to be almost a total face mask, and the equipment was huge, or they had an oxygen tank beside their bed. Now they have these little generators and that just you plug in, and they're small, and some of them just have a nasal cannula or just a little nasal face mask that fits just over the nose. Others have one that fits over the mouth.
Now, if I was wearing one of these, though, would it drive my wife nuts? Or
well, at one time, they were very noisy. Now they're pretty quiet. If she woke up and saw a monster laying there with a mask on, she might get frightened.
But I could say, hey, in the long term, I'm going to look better.
That's right. I'll look better during the day, honey. Just turn your back to me at night.
Oh, man. So, anyway, but they've gotten smaller. So
much smaller, much quieter, and much more effective in terms of helping people that have sleep apnea.
Now, if you're using one of those devices, are you going to have to use that for the rest of your life?
Well, probably in a lot of cases that would be true, because what happens is that the brain, area of brain that normally stimulates breathing, respiration, just doesn't seem to be sensitive at night. And so for a lot of people, unless it is related to a heavy cold or infection or some other process, it probably is going to be for a lifetime.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, it must be. Maybe somebody's just sleeping so deeply that...
Well, that's part of
is
it.
Is that part of it?
Yeah, that's
where
part of it.
Your brain is just shut off?
It shuts down.
Wow. Okay. Well, boy, I tell you what, the hour goes fast here, Doctor. We had some really good calls here today, and we appreciate the folks who called in. And you're going to be back next week, right?
I will be back, and we'll have Bill Ladwig back to talk about some of the drugs that are...
He's from Lewis, right?
He's from Lewis Pharmacy.
Talking about drugs, what?
We'll be talking about new drugs coming down the pike, those that are going off market, and those becoming generic, and maybe planning your...